Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 140 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast, presented by New York's iconic Empire Hotel. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of Broadway's biggest stars, a man who just picked up his third Tony nomination in 4 years, this one in the category of Best Actor in a Musical for the musical adaptation of the 1993 film Groundhog Day that's currently running at the August Wilson Theater on 52nd Street, and a man who might well take home his first Tony Award on June 11th, the great Andy Karl. Karl, whose previous Tony nominations came for 2014's Rocky in the category of Best Actor in a Musical and 2015's On the 20th Century in the category of Best Featured Actor in a Musical, has had a remarkable journey to this point. But it's a journey that has never been more remarkable than it is at this very moment, when the dashing 43-year-old, who I've previously described as Broadway's version of Cary Grant, only buffer and with a great singing voice, is giving 8 remarkable performances a week in Groundhog Day, despite tearing his ACL on the stage on April 14th, just 72 hours before opening night. Over the course of our conversation at the Empire Hotel, Karl and I discussed a wide range of topics, among them how a working-class kid from Baltimore found his way into local summer and dinner theater, what inspired his move to New York in 1994, and what he was up to during the 6 years before he landed his first Broadway gig there as a replacement in Saturday Night Fever, how just 6 months after joining that production, he wound up married to one of his co-stars, the actress Orfe, with whom he would also later appear on Broadway in Legally Blonde, what it's like stepping into an already up-and-running Broadway smash, which he did as a replacement in Wicked and Jersey Boys, as opposed to helping to create a show from the ground up, as he did with the musical adaptations of Rocky and Groundhog Day, how his performance in On the 20th Century, in a part that Kevin Kline originated and won a Tony for 37 years earlier, helped to pave the way for Groundhog Day, what it's been like bringing Groundhog Day from London, where it was a smash hit at the Old Vic and Karl's performance was recognized with an Olivier Award, to New York, and what it's been like in New York since he went down with his gruesome injury several weeks ago, and then, to the disbelief of many around him, almost immediately got back up. So, without further ado, let's go to that conversation.
Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team, led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Andy, thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We always begin by asking just a basic one. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
Way back in the day. Back in the day. I'm from Baltimore, Maryland, where I was born and raised, in the suburbs. And, well, I was born more in the city area. Then we moved to the suburbs. But my mother is a teacher, so she's taught everything from middle school, being a librarian, to elementary music, and she also plays organ for her church. So music was all around in when I was growing up. So that's kind of how the attraction to music. And she had like the West Side Story and Jesus Christ Superstar albums and that kind of stuff. And my father is an appliance refinisher, housing contractor type of all handyman sort of thing. So
you grew up around her musical influence, I guess. It sounds like she's playing, she's got other introducing you to some Broadway. But you initially were not on this trajectory, from what I've read. You were kind of more of the athletic guy?
My older brother was the superior athlete. He was the football guy. And so I sort of was pushed in thinking that I would be following his footsteps. So then I got hit really hard during football in high school, and I never really felt, you know, this was my thing. Because my brother, he had much more size than I had. I was just sort of like, you know, I had size, but I was skinny.
Right.
So when I got hit that hard, all of a sudden it came clear to me I needed to be an artist.
Okay.
So I was actually like at the same time becoming involved with painting and drawing. The arts were kind of like something I was very attracted to. Music, of course, from being at home. But then I went to Maryland Art Institute for a couple summers studying painting and drawing. And my I'd also been singing in like the choir and stuff in mm-hmm. high school. So my life was sort of centered around the arts yeah. in that way. Always played baseball yeah. and soccer growing up, all that little league stuff, and then doing a little bit of high school stuff. And after that, I kind of like, I'm good.
So if we showed up at one of your high school reunions and grabbed somebody and said, what would you have guessed Andy was going to do with his life? What would they have said?
I wonder if that. They probably thought I'd be a stoner somewhere, I'm sure. I was a dreamer and I was a singer. I think people thought like, you know, you have something to do with singing and maybe teaching. And that's what I was actually went to Towson State University to sort of pursue teaching. Mm-hmm. Then I realized that was another thing I didn't want to do. Right. Not to say that teaching isn't a very, very nice career, but it's something where I had the pull to perform. Right.
Well, let's go back first to Towson High School. Is this where you acted for the first time?
Yeah. Towson High School in the summer musicals. It's public high school. So, you know, we had these, I think they had two shows a year or something like that. And then the summer they would do a musical. And there was a little Abner and what else was there? Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. So there was this other kid, and he would get all the lead roles. Evan Farmer, still remember his name.
Son of a bitch.
He would always get the lead roles, and I would always be the villain.
Right.
Which I think is fantastic, actually. I was like, how could I be in that role? And that's actually really interesting, because I broke my foot when I was Judd in Oklahoma.
Really?
Skateboarding, so I broke my foot.
You have some experience.
So I had a cast
with this, yeah.
for the entire run of the show.
Oh, you kept going.
Yeah. So that's where that whole... Yes. Keep the show running yes. attitude came from. But yeah, I was General Bullmoose and Lil Abner to Evan's Lil Abner. So yeah, there was something there about like finding out that I could do characters and, right. and having a great time with that.
And then, but this was not going to be a career path until you got into a little bit of trouble. Is that correct?
I mean, yeah, before getting into all the musicals and like my mother knew I could sing and yeah. everything. But, you know, my brother and I, we were, you know, two boys in the family.
right.
And so we would just do, you know, what boys do and, yeah. you know, get into trouble every now and again. But the one stupid thing is, the one thing I got caught doing and suspended from school for a couple of days was smoking in the boys' room, which is the total cliche. And it was the first time. And it was like a friend of mine was in the bathroom when I was going to the bathroom. I was actually going to the bathroom, like, you know, as people do.
Yes.
There he was smoking, hands it to me. I'm like, okay, one puff. Boom. Vice principal comes in. Done.
Did he go down too, though?
Because he's slick. He's probably been caught before. He ditched it. And like, he was like claiming I didn't do it. And and I was just like sort of flabbergasted because I didn't know how to talk my way out of things.
Right.
And I got pulled down and my mother came in. My mother was like, okay, we need to keep you busy with yeah. things. So I got sort of, she wanted me to go audition for a kid's show. And I immediately auditioned. I got this lead role of Aladdin.
Well, now when you say a kid's show, though, yeah. we're talking about out of school, like more professional type thing?
Yeah, it was like kids' performances in the summer were like, you know, on a Tuesday afternoon for a audience of children mm-hmm. and their parents. And they would do, you know, like Aladdin, what we did at the White Marsh Dinner Theater.
Gotcha.
And it was my first role and I was the lead and I was like, wow, this is amazing. But mostly...
Are they paying you at that point?
I don't know how much it was.
I think it was
being paid in like peanut butter right. jelly sandwiches or something. But it was sort of a proud position to be employed as a singer. And it was my first job. But I found the family of theater there.
Yeah.
And that was the most important thing.
And I may have some chronology wrong here, but who is Toby Orenstein?
Toby Orenstein runs Toby's Dinner yes. Theater in Columbia, Maryland. And it was a professional dinner theater. It was sort of like the next level up. It was yep. 8 shows a week. Yes, there were servers and we could serve, but you weren't required to serve drinks to everybody.
So
but
were you going right from that other dinner theater to this bigger one? Is that what it was?
I hit all of them in Baltimore.
Yeah,
let me
yeah.
tell you, I was on Pulaski Highway.
All
at the
while you're
Act
still in high school
theater.
Or
oh,
now?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that when I found the family of theater, I knew this is what I wanted to
and
do.
And you went all
it was an immediate spark of what I wanted to be involved with. And It kept me out of trouble,
yeah.
but B, it gave me something to pursue in life.
Yeah.
That was that one time where I really thought, like, this is an occupation I want to do. But Toby's was the next level up, where it's, I got out of high school and now I'm in college, but
over at Towson University, still near Baltimore.
I was hired to do this show, 8 shows a week, which required full time. Mm. So I did 2 years of college. Then I decided I want to pursue this and see what happens.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where it jettisoned.
Who is Todd Parathree? Is that pronouncing it correctly?
Todd Parathree, yes, that is correct. He was the first person while I was doing a show. I was doing Grease at Towson State University, another like summer musical. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. College productions tend to have a lot of more production value. And there's people who are studying this, so we're all trying to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
And hired in as the lead for that one as well, which, you know, I was very grateful for, also sort of intimidated, but it was my, there's a lot of pressure at that point, at that time.
Yeah.
And Todd Parathree, who he's one of those directors, he's very smart, but he's also very cynical, and he's also very, he doesn't like to waste time. Right, so, you know, if he's talking to you, it's like, you better be mind your P's and Q's.
Right.
And I never expected this to come from him, but he pulled me aside one day. He's like, I really think you should try pursuing this. He gave me that speech, which I wasn't expecting. And I still remember it to this day. And it's sort of stuck in my head. And I will never forget that, because that's really that was the time where I was like, let's do this.
Because at that point you were a sophomore or something?
Yeah, sophomore in
or just going into probably between sophomore and what would have been junior.
Yeah, it was, or maybe it was freshman. After something freshman like
that.
Year.
But so ultimately the thing that comes of that is that you make this decision. You're going to go give it a shot in New York.
Yep.
And so you come out in 1994. Just logistically, what did that entail?
Luckily, I had met a friend who was in sort of in the same circuit as I was. She had moved up here before me, and she was renting a very small apartment. You know, this is the New York excursion dream that you have. I had about $3,000 in my wallet and just sort of like the dream to come up here and try it and look at Backstage Magazine and look at all the auditions and just start going.
Yeah.
And I knew from the fact that I studied music, but I'd never really studied acting in musical theater. I sort of just came upon it through experience and through working at all those dinner theaters. So I had a little bit of experience that way, but I knew I had a lot to learn.
Yeah.
So any job that I would get, it was like, I would just soak in everything and I would talk to the lead actors who were equity actors hired from New York. And
because at that point you're out here, and from 1994, I guess, until 2000, I think your Broadway debut was in 2000. What happened in the interim? You have to get an agent. You have to, kind of work were you doing in those years?
You know, you start off doing, of course, one of the first jobs I got was a dinner theater called the Carousel Dinner Theater
out around
in Akron,
here?
Ohio.
Oh,
Akron,
really? Ohio. Oh, so you left town.
Yeah, there was a lot of leaving town to go do these quick gigs that were like maybe 2 months at a time, because they had these, they do circuits of shows at these places, and most of them, you know, big musicals.
Yeah.
So there I would be in the ensemble, just, you know, and, you know, having, I'd get a few lines and thinking this was great. You know, it was great. It was great to have a few lines to say, you know, be a part of the process.
Right.
So, you know, shows there, shows in like, in Pennsylvania. Oh man, I forget the names of these theaters there. And back then you would acquire points or something to get your equity card.
Okay.
So you would work at several weeks.
So you even get those from the dinner theater?
Because they were equity houses. They would hire equity. So it would be about like, you know, they'd hire all these non-equity actors to come in. And we, I don't know how we did it, but we would check off the points and here's my employment and I'd go to equity and here's my 180 weeks or what, I don't remember how, 18 weeks it could have been under certain employment.
For somebody who's not in this business or familiar with it, what is the value of attaining equity status?
What is the value of attaining equity status? Well, I mean, equity is a... is a union that covers your medical expenses,
So that's
mostly.
Right.
But it's also this sort of form of community that now you are sort of a professional equity actor, there are things required of you, but there's also things, you know, you have to work a certain amount of weeks to stay in equity.
Yeah.
So it actually pushes you and drives you to find better and better projects and to make yourself better and better in the interim. So from there, that was just a sort of a status that became a thing that I wanted to pursue. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's plenty of people in non-equity shows out there you know, living their dream as well. Yeah. I've done plenty of them. So I felt just as good doing those shows as I do now. I think equity just has standards, especially like you don't have to wash your own costumes, that kind of thing. Maybe you do.
Right.
But there's certain requirements upon everybody to become better. And that's sort of how it just kept going.
A quick dinner theater aside. Do you get dinner when you work at dinner theater?
You can. Yeah.
You pay for it.
There's leftovers.
Oh,
we still have a lot of chicken left over. So that's what you're eating that night.
Okay.
Come on, man. I was cutting my teeth.
Right. So now, how do you get an agent? What was the thing that made that possible?
I was on the tour of Cats.
Yes.
Which is now across the street from where I work
now. That's right. Rum Tum Tugger.
Rum Tum Tugger, yeah. There was a girl who was playing Grisabella in the show. She had an agent. They came out to see her. And she introduced me to them, and that's what it was. It was just like, hi, how are you? And I would really like to, you know, pursue, you know, having an agent. They immediately signed me, and it was great. Came back to New York and had a lot of money saved from Cats. And from then on, they and I, like, worked on getting the next project.
And that would have been Saturday Night Fever? Was that the big thing that came from having an agent?
The cool thing came from Saturday Night, which was Sondheim Saturday Night off Broadway. And that was basically my first in-town big show was working with Sondheim.
Mm-hmm. Were you actually working with Sondheim?
Sondheim was there.
Wow.
I was the swing. I was one of the swings. So the other guys were working directly with him, but I was there.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. I'm working with, you know, Stephen Sondheim and on one of my first off-Broadway shows. And there was clearly a ton of respect on all sides. And Kathleen Marshall was directing as well, and there were some great actors that were in that piece. And actually, Matthew Warchus's wife was in that, so that's how I knew her before.
That's so funny.
He knew her.
So that was well received off Broadway. And then, how do you first hear about this opportunity? They're looking for a replacement for Joey, Tony Manero's buddy, in Saturday Night Fever on Broadway, where you had never worked prior to that.
It's true. I had also, when I came back to New York and was doing Saturday Night, before I started doing the show, I had tried to see as many Broadway shows as I could. So, but that was in like the Footloose era.
Yeah.
So my wife, Orfe, was in that show. She was actually, had taken over for the one of the Rusty in that show. So
we should say your wife in the future. She was not yet.
She was not my wife at that point.
Yes.
And so I had seen her in Footloose. I was like, who is this? Badass, killing it up there. And then I kept seeing more shows. I saw Saturday Night Fever, and I saw her tear down the house with If I Can't Have You, and as Annette in that role. And I just, you know, enamored by her, and I would just stare at her photo outside of the stage door, not really realizing that I would someday be there. But I knew in the pursuit of seeing something like Saturday Night Fever, and I was going to dance class a lot, and I was like, this is the energy I want.
Yeah.
This is what I want to do, and I respect it so much, and I see these guys up there just having a blast and having this amazing show. It was about that energy, and that's kind of energy I still like to use, is something that's as big as like a Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
And it was just great, and so I somehow got an audition. It was me and Joey McIntyre from New Kids on the Block were auditioning for the replacement. And I was like, how's Joey Max here? So seeing all the, you know, coming across all these things, you realize that celebrities and people who are in equity and people who seemed sort of this unattainable status, I was just, you know, running into as I was, you know, pursuing my career.
Yeah.
And you realize that you become on the same level, essentially, or you're getting to that level. And it just, you know, kept building confidence.
And so you remember how you found out you'd gotten the part?
Yeah, I think I was doing some non-equity show at the time. I was like, I got to leave, you guys. I actually got a big Broadway show, and I got the call, and it was just kind of amazing. And the rehearsal. I'd never been in a Broadway rehearsal situation where it was, you know, it's like you and the dance captain learning a whole bunch of choreography for Saturday Night Fever. It was exhausting. And I can't say that I was such a technical dancer that I knew everything I was doing, but there were a lot of lifts in that show. Again, like back in the day when I was learning all the time, I was still learning so much all at once, trying to push fear away and just like, let's get this and make this happen. So that was an incredible experience, very exhausting. And then becoming really, you know, so much elation from doing a show and being on Broadway. And I walked out on stage, and much like high school, when I got my first laugh from an audience and a Broadway audience, the best feeling ever.
I was going to ask you, do you remember anything specifically about that night you made your debut?
I remember nailing my triple turn. Then I had one line that was kind of like, you know, Joey throws out a line. I think he's talking about some chick that Tony is seeing. He's like, yeah, you nail something derogatory, but the audience laughed. Right. And I was like, I got my laugh on Broadway. Oh my God.
You made it. Yeah.
And yeah. It's still true to this day. Anytime the audience laughs at things, I'm just it's energy. It's food for my soul.
Now, in the meantime, you are now working alongside this aforementioned actress in Saturday Night Fever, who you'd had some attraction to, and 6 months later you're married. What the hell happened so quickly there?
As I was getting into the show and preparing for the show, the hair designer for the show, you know, my hair is actually lighter naturally, so they had to darken me up to make me Italian, and I played more Italians on Broadway than I can possibly imagine, even in SVU, and they were like, okay, you have to look like Peter Gallagher, so we're gonna dye your hair. I was like, can I not dye my hair for something?
Did they bushy your eyebrows a little too?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, and we pulled it off because I've heard so many people say, like, you guys look like you're related. Okay. But the hair designer for Saturday Night Fever, I knew from something else, and he knew Orfe very well. So he would talk about us through him. Mm-hmm. Like, and then I would say something, like, we'll tell her, I say hello.
Did you
tell
know? Her. So you knew this was an intermediary.
So, in some form, it's like, you guys are going to like each other. Right. And, you know, we first got there, and, you know, I was still like, cutting my teeth and trying to fit in and stuff like that. But Orfe was just being so sweet to me and really kind, and really, we were just laughing and really hit it off right away and started dating like a month later. And then it was like, boom, let's do it. let's jump in. I mean, much like this whole career, this whole, you know, wanting to pursue something, you have to jump in and see what happens. And so, you know, 20 years later doing this stuff and 16 years later being married for 16 years, you know, things have been consistent and wonderful.
Yeah. Well, one thing though that I imagine might have been a little challenging then and must always, I would imagine, be a tough thing when you're both performers is that, so you guys get married like a couple weeks after Saturday Night Fever closes, right? Mm-hmm. And a week later you got to go on a national tour, right?
Yeah.
And she was not.
She was not. No, she's like, I don't want to go on tour.
Yeah.
I had actually been on tour with Cats and with a non-equity version of Tommy. So I actually liked touring. I liked seeing the country, that kind of things. But also they were to be connected with Saturday Night Fever, which was my first Broadway show. I thought like, well, heck, here's the job. They're offering me to go on tour and they're going to be paying me. It's like, got to go where the work is. Yeah. It was one of those decisions that it's like, then I went out and then I realized like this kind of sucks being away from each other for so long. And she came out to LA or came out to like a couple places we were at, but it still was just like sort of, we were newly married, but I was also, but we're both in pursuit of career. And work, whatever career is. I don't know what career is anymore. It's just, it's more like, let's just work.
Right.
So it worked out fine. It was, but I was so committed to doing that show. And that's really one thing I just care about in my life is like the show must go on.
Yeah.
So stuck with it. Barely remember any of it. Just sort of did it and came back. We ended up doing a show intermittently during, I took a break from Saturday Night Fever where Orfe and I could work together in Philadelphia for a couple weeks or a month. Then I went back on tour for a couple more months and then I was back.
And so Saturday Night Fever, your involvement was like starting around 2000 when it was on Broadway, then national tour for what, like a year or so after that?
Something like that, yeah.
And then what I'm just trying to see here is, so you and Orfe ended up working together again in Legally Blonde, mm-hmm. which is 2007. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, again, just so people can kind of appreciate, I think they see you when you're on Broadway, and so they're, oh, Andy, you know, there he is again. But there are sometimes periods of time between these shows when you guys have to, you know, you find other things to grind out and do and whatever. So in that interim period between Saturday Night Fever and Legally Blonde, what's it, a lot of off-Broadway stuff, or what was going on then?
You know, wherever the jobs were, I think I did, gosh, these are just great career moves. Happy Days at the Falcon Theater, but working with the late Gary Marshall,
right,
which was awesome. I took over, full circle, took over for Joey McIntyre.
Oh, my God.
Ken, yeah, this is a very strange, weird world. Right. He was doing it out there, and then they called me up because I had auditioned for it a while back and went back out there. After that, came back and jumped right into The Wedding Singer for like 6 months or something mm-hmm. like that. And those in-between times, I'm sure I was working. I can, you know, it becomes one of those things where, you know, the gypsy actor comes out and you're just like, where's the work? Yeah. You got to find it, especially when you're just trying to establish more and more of your name. And that's really the biggest thing on my side, you know, through the past years is gaining relationships with people, and they know they can trust me and I can trust them. And
but when there's something like a period of 7 years between Saturday Night Fever and next time you're on Broadway with Legally Blonde, how much of it is I'm happy because I'm working and doing things that I enjoy, and how much of it is I'm concerned, am I going to get back to be on Broadway again?
You know, there's always, never ever do I not finish a job and think, oh, I'm set. I'm going to get those phone calls. I'm going to be rolling in right now. I'll be pushing people away.
Right.
I don't think any actor must feel that way. I mean, maybe Morgan Freeman. Maybe he can relax.
Right.
Because they'll just call him up to do a voiceover or something. There's no actor out there. I don't even think there's any job that's like, yeah, I'm so secure.
Right.
I'm going to get my pension. We're going to be great. Right. It's about finding the next thing. But that's also that's the energy of an actor, which is great because mm-hmm. we are in, when we're doing a show, we're thinking about four other things that we can be working on to mm-hmm. progress whatever else we've got going on.
And you're writing music backstage.
Writing
stuff,
music.
Yeah.
I was, but you know, in that before Legally Blonde was also Altar Boys, which was one of the greatest experiences. It was an off-Broadway show, but it was a show about being together as a team and becoming close as actors and close as friends and close as their characters on stage. Mm-hmm. That I learned a lot just from doing that show, and that was the energy I wanted to do. And it was also a very good showcase for all of us.
Right.
It was so much a showcase that that's when Jerry Mitchell came to see it. That's when Jerry Mitchell said, do you want to be in Legally Blonde? I think you'd be great in whatever I put you in. I was like, yeah, let's do it. So it became that. And then from Legally Blonde, Joe Mantello saw me and put me in 9 to 5.
Right.
And from there, it's like, you know, he put me in Wicked after that closed. And so again, that whole it's thing is like, I've never felt like I've been so unsuccessful and I've had a terrible career in any case, well, in any setting. It's just been a matter of like, I love this. This is my passion. This is what I want to do.
Yeah,
it's turned into different things since those days, and I've not. I also like to learn as much as I can about everything, including writing music, mm-hmm. including acting. So I've had great opportunities in the last just 5 years that have changed my whole perspective of what I do.
Well, let's just briefly go through a few of these others now that you were becoming kind of a regular guy here on Broadway with, I guess, starting Legally Blonde. You're playing the UPS delivery man who attracts the character played by Orfe.
Yep.
In part with one iconic line, which we might prompt you.
Yeah, that was the UPS guy as they deliver. This one says, I've got a package. And it's, you know, it's supposed to be, you know, an innuendo as well.
Of course.
And I played the hilt out of it, and getting that laugh,
that was a good one.
It was a great laugh.
Right. And working every night now, 8 times a week with your wife.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a healthy thing when you're now, you know, it's one thing when you're attracted and you're kind of courting somebody or whatever, but now was it fun, or do you sometimes need a little bit of a separation between home and work?
Yeah, we've had plenty of separation. So it's like when we can be in the same place at one time on the same schedule, that's easier, way easier. And it's, you know, good to walk home with somebody. You know?
Yeah.
It just gives you the opportunity to be in the same place at the same time. Yeah. Right now, we don't, she has to, you know, she's waiting for me to finish the show every mm-hmm. night, but she's also got, she's doing her voiceover. Yeah. She's doing workshops. She's doing all sorts of stuff
right.
that make us see each other in the night. Like, hi, got to go to sleep. See you in the morning. Right. I got to go now to the next thing. So
tough, yeah.
that ends up being weirder and harder because now it's more important for me to like make those dinner dates
right.
and tell her I love her every day yes. and sort of, so just make sure that I'm connecting.
Sure. So you mentioned Joe Mantello as the thread that leads to 9 to 5, I guess, having seen you in Legally Blonde, you do that. Then there was this string of things that we should mention where you were a replacement in some of the biggest shows that have ever existed on Broadway, and certainly in this century. So you go in 2010 in Wicked.
Joey McIntyre was also in that.
Was it? That's right.
I'm putting it all
yeah,
together.
Yeah, we
got to
keep it going. Yeah, yeah. And then 2011, you're Tommy DeVito, the black sheep in Jersey Boys, mm-hmm. which goes basically through 2013 with the exception of a few months when you went and did The Mystery of Edwin Drood, mm-hmm. which that one, I guess, in a way, really seems like a turning point, right? Because you got a lot of individual recognition for that. And want to talk about that. But first of all, I think we got to just go back to what is it like when you're stepping into what is already a monster hit like a Wicked or a Jersey Boys? Is that intimidating?
Oh, those are very two different, totally different experiences. Going into Wicked, I already felt going into it that it was like this global thing. It was something that needed to be a certain way in a certain type of show and a certain, there was parameters of things I could do. And by this time, I was like, I was used to like, let's make up something that'll hit home right. on a different level. It's my own yeah. thing. So it's not that they squelched it as opposed to like, we have to keep it the context right. of the show
constrain
because
it yeah.
now and forever of Wicked.
Right.
And it is a beautiful show.
Yeah.
I actually like was able to sit in the orchestra at times because I had time off stage. Mm-hmm. I was able to watch a lot of the scenes from off stage and just watch the magic of that show and also watch the heart of that show. And I think it's, I mean, there's some friends that I have that like, oh, you know, it's all fluff and stuff. It's like, no, this actually is a very deep story. And right. It hits home to a lot of people. So I sort of experienced that as well as I could and wore the tight white pants as best I could and sang the song as best I could. I never felt like it was mine
right.
in that experience. On the other side of it, Jersey Boys, I felt when I saw it, I was like, I know what I can do with this role. And there's a lot of dialogue and there's a lot of monologuing to the audience and cutting into song and sort of like finessing a lot of the stuff that needs to be, that you have to own. So I felt like as soon as I got that, I know all the lines, I know how this is going to work, but I know that there's some of the stuff that I'm watching right now. I know the jokes can land a lot harder if you're playing that guy that everybody loves to hate who's got a lot of charm.
Right.
So it was in that sense, I was able to be free with the character, obviously staying within the parameters of how the show works. That is another global thing. But if you don't have those four guys have a dynamic on stage, you're not going to feel what you feel every night watching that show. And I know from just experiencing it. And that's when I had such a great time with those guys as well. I knew we needed to connect on a friendship level and on stage.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of ping pong going out there. So it was great. So in those two shows, I learned a great deal. And I'm constantly learning every show that I do. I don't want to do something where it's like, you know, old hat.
Yeah.
So replacing was actually a great experience for me. And I was, you know, used to that back in the days when I did Cats.
Right,
so
right.
I understood it. And Starlight Express back in the day. Right. So I thank Andrew Lloyd Webber for the employment.
Now, what was it, though, about Edwin Drood that convinced you to step away from Jersey Boys for... I don't know if you knew when you stepped away that it was for a finite period of time and you would come back, but what was it that even brought that about in the first place?
I didn't know I'd come back, but Scott Ellis called me directly to look at me for this role, and I was like, "How would I don't get it. Like, here's the thing that directors have that I don't understand."
Right.
And maybe if I were put in that position to hire people, I would get is how they see it. Still, Groundhog Day, I was not like, how do you see this? And it works out great. Right. So being cast in Edward Drood, it was sort of a prestige for, it was part of Roundabout. It was right. part of an organization that does great theater and also hires top-notch people.
Yeah, yeah.
It's where I met Chita Rivera, yeah. who became a dear friend, and Will Chase, and all those guys who were in that show, just...
And young talent, too, right? It's you and Jesse Mueller.
Yeah, and Jesse Mueller. We hit it off, and right. we would have ridiculous amount of fun on stage. And she just took off in her career. Mm-hmm. Still two people that I consider myself humble in the presence of mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. is talent and this whole amazing thing with Broadway. But Jesse Mueller, just as humble and being able to, you know, have the trajectory and be humble, which is... This is a great thing to have. Mm-hmm. It's something that, you know, working with somebody like Chita Rivera, you go, wow, here's this legend. She's still rocking it out and giving 110% and still just as accessible as a person mm-hmm. as can be. And so, you know, she taught me a lot. She's still teaching me a lot, mm-hmm. especially like from my injury recently.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like, here's someone who wrote me letters and texted me and still...
Her leg had been shattered when she came back, right?
Yeah, so she had respect for that,
yes.
for what I was doing. Right. I was like, you have respect for me because I have nothing but respect right. for you. And just a few months ago, we had done the Carnegie Hall concert that was Cheetah's Carnegie Hall concert, and she asked me to be part of that. So, you know, it's all in respect.
Sure.
You know, coming from, you know, the dinner theater days to now, it's a really... Oh, great leap in those experiences.
Quick jump back for 1 second to mm-hmm. Jersey Boys. That almost, just even the opportunity to audition to do that almost did not happen, right?
Oh, I'm sure.
Well, in the sense, like literally, it seemed like it was kind of a curse there.
I sort of like, that was one of those points where I was like, I don't have any work. My agents, hey, do you guys know of anything going on? They said like, yeah, well, actually they're auditioning for Jersey Boys. Great. So I go there. The first time I go to audition, I think there was what was that? It was one of the hurricanes, something. It wasn't Sandy, but it was right. a hurricane, so couldn't go that day. The next time it happened, next time I was able to go back, one of the biggest earthquakes that's hit New York
right.
happened. So
right.
that day didn't happen. It was really strange how things worked out that way. Almost, you know, the gods telling me not to right, go do it or something. But I stand in defiance of all the gods now.
Sure. The last 4 years, which happened to coincide with when I've been covering this stuff and have really been paying attention, this is why I'm particularly curious about these next questions that are coming up, because I've sort of seen the fruits of what we're about to talk about. So Rocky was on Broadway in 2014. It actually, though, took a number of years, like longer than usual, and longer than many instances, to come to fruition. You first heard about it, and again, this is a musical version of Rocky, you first heard about in 2011. How did it cross your radar, and how did you go after it?
My agent, Richard Schminner from Paradigm, mm-hmm. who's actually, he just retired. Mm. He knows everything that's going on. So he says, they're auditioning for Rocky the Musical. And like many of, I'm sure your listeners probably thought, what a bad idea. I certainly was like, really? Is it going to be like a sarcastic, you know, pun about this show? Should I come in with a side of beef and hit it? So he told me it's very serious. Stallone is involved. Aarons and Flaherty are involved, and how these were, you know, names of people that are huge, mm-hmm. bigger than big. So, okay, they're taking it seriously. Then I went back and watched the film and realized how intimate the film is and really took a good look at it and really looked at these characters for what they are and, you know, then sort of standing in awe of, like, how Stallone came up with this and pursued it and how he got the movie done, and also the humility of that character. That totally intrigued me. They sent me the music and the sides, which were just beautiful, like intimate stories. And then the music was epic in many ways. So I went in, and immediately when I was getting prepared to audition, I was like, this feels right. Something about this feels like it connects with me. You know, I could drop into my low baritone. I could stay there. This is, you know, all those musicals that used to be great in the old days, the baritone songs mm-hmm. were powerful. Baritone ideas were
that's sort of where I learned everything. Yeah. Everything became tenor after that, you know, with Wicked's and all that kind of stuff. So I was able to sort of sit in that and feel comfortable in it, and also sort of see a mountain in front of me with Stallone at the top of it. And I said, is this the time when I climb the freaking mountain and ask that trainer over there, I need you. I need to look, you know, as big as I can, and ask myself, like, what can I do? Am I ready for this? I want to tear down everything and climb mountains.
And this is just to get the part.
I want to show everybody what I got.
Yeah.
That's also, you know, a humble, beautiful character with a lot of heart. So I auditioned, and I think, I sent in a video audition from Atlanta when I was doing some movie, and it didn't come out very big, but they saw something with the little two inch screen that they were looking at, and then called me back. And it was like, I think we all realized it in the room.
Stallone was in the room at that
Stallone
point.
Stallone was not in the room.
Not yet?
He came to the reading.
The first reading, okay.
At Juilliard. And I realized, you know, after about, I don't know, 2 weeks of rehearsal while we're doing the reading, and we're, you know, and I'm like, yo, how you doing? And Stallone walks in, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to do this, my voice in this character, 5 feet away from where he's sitting. And I was just something about it. I was like, this is going to be, to me, it seemed funny to do this. Yeah. It's a once in a lifetime experience. And it was great. And he was like, how you
had the part already or not yet?
I was doing the reading. Okay. So I had it for that.
Right.
No guarantees for anything else.
And in fact, what ended up happening was that for whatever their reasons, I guess, I don't recall why, they decide we're going to do this in Germany first.
Yeah.
Meaning we got to get a guy that speaks German. So therefore, for whatever the period that was going to be, a year, it had gone away from you after all this work, and there's no promise that it's coming back, right?
No, I think that was one of those things where I really fell in love with the role, and it was like, this is a bad position to be in, where it's going to go away for a year and come back. And I'm not in that echelon of actors who, like, he's that name that's going to push this through.
At that time.
And so, you know, I was just worried. For a year, I was sort of like, talking myself down off of, you know.
Because let's just talk this through. If it does well in Germany, then maybe they can come get a big, big name here.
Well, also the actor in Germany was an American actor who'd been over there for a long time.
So he spoke English.
He could very well have come back.
And if it didn't do well, who's going to want to do it on Broadway?
Yeah. I mean, their challenge, their mission was to bring it back always. But I was told it was going to be a year till that happens. And so that's, you know, it was a waiting game for that. And when the call came through, and I actually went back to the callbacks for it to come back a year later. And
so you had to win it all over again.
Yeah. I was like, I'm not losing this. So, and I had gone into training before that just to, like, get a little size on. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is mine. Mm-hmm. I had to feel that way. And if I didn't get it, it would suck. But if I got it, it's, at least I worked for it. Taught me a lesson to, like, you know, if you're in pursuit of something, really, you know, give yourself a kick in the pants and do it.
Well, this brings us to what I have pieced together from various interviews was a very interesting, basically, like, 24-hour period on or about, like, June 9th, 2013. There were several crazy things happening within, like, a day or two in your life then, right? You're doing a movie with Michael Douglas and Rob Reiner.
I was in Jersey. I was back in Jersey Boys after Drood.
Right.
Because I loved the show a lot. It was still, like, a big part of my falling in love with acting. And then I got hired to do a movie with Rob Reiner directing and Michael Douglas and Diane Keaton starring. And I was heading out to Connecticut because I had the days to shoot and then come back and do the show Jersey Boys at night. But I was heading back for my first day of shooting. And that's when I got the call from my agent that I had just booked Rocky. So I was sort of living this actor's dream movie. We're also working at night. And I just got hired for one of the biggest shows I've ever been up for.
And that night or the next night or something, like, right in that same period, was you're in the opening number of the Tonys.
Oh, yeah. So we had done the Tonys the night before I was going out.
Right.
So the front page of, like, the Connecticut Times or whatever was sitting on the table in front of, and Rob Reiner's reading it, and I'm on the front picture
doing the opening,
you know, with, like, my picture with the Jersey Boys. Right. We were doing the opening number.
Which, by the way, I just rewatched. This is the opening of the 2013 Tonys, which today there have been, you know, kind of articles and things. This is probably the greatest opening of any award show ever. This is like, can you tell people what they missed in short? Like all of Broadway and Neil Patrick Harris, right?
Everybody was on stage and Neil Patrick Harris. Yeah, I think it's the Tonys does it right. I mean, look, it's the greatest amount of people with so much talent on stage all at once.
Right.
That something good's got to come out of it. I mean, I really like, I like the Oscars and mm-hmm. I like all that mm-hmm. stuff. I like all those award shows. But I mean, with when you watch the Tonys, it's kind of it's like different. You know, you have a unique experience to watch some incredible talent. I think a lot of the award shows are getting bigger and bigger. The mm-hmm. Olivier's is getting bigger and bigger. They're at the Royal Albert Hall now. Yeah, so it's production value. It's also this kind of stuff makes for great theater.
Well, you go to the Oscars, you don't see people performing their scenes. You go to the Grammys, they might sing a song. But here you're seeing why people are being recognized there. Yeah. But anyway, so you coming back, so that was the day you find out you've got the part in Rocky. It's now going to be a $16.5 million show, which is significantly large. You're originating it from a classic movie that people know and love. And you know, we've talked about some of the physical work that goes into just looking the part, but then you've got to play the part every night where one boxing scene is 5 minutes, another is 20 minutes at the end, the unbelievable finale. There's a reason that there haven't been many boxing movies on Broadway, because it's so hard probably just to stage, let alone to beat somebody up. And so when you're, you know, getting ready to go into this, what was your feeling? Are you confident? Are you concerned? Are you nervous? Like, what was the vibe here?
I mean, any movie to musical transfer comes with a bit of a skepticism for audiences. They go, and especially something like Rocky, which is hugely iconic, and that character is just such a staple in people's brains. That staple in a brain, that's a weird saying. I'm going to trademark that one.
Right.
It was sort of like, okay, let's see how this does. But I also think that it did not get its just due mm-hmm. as far as the stagecraft was really astounding.
Yeah.
I mean, people do remember the last 20 minutes of the show mm-hmm. because it was the most incredible thing, where this ring came down from the ceiling, took over the first 8 rows of the audience. The audience got up and sat behind like they were in a real event.
Unbelievable.
And the way that everything worked the way it did was an enormous amount of effort. But in that frame, how do you advertise this type of thing?
Right.
How do you sell it to make it, you know, something that people will just come see? So there's a whole bunch of things I have to fire correctly in order for a musical to get where it is. So, mm-hmm. but my job was, I'm Rocky, find the heart, find the truth of all these mm-hmm. things. Don't, if you're gonna talk like this, it better sound like it's coming from your heart. You know what I'm saying? Because I can still drop into it now, and I can still talk to you like I'm actually Rocky. Because that's what Stallone did. Stallone, when he saw the reading for the first time, was talking the way that Stallone does, which is low, but it's not Rocky. Then he dropped into Rocky to show me how the character is. His eyes sort of glazed over. His mouth became a little bit more of a draw, and his shoulders started moving. I saw everything that he did to create that character, mm-hmm. and I did everything I could to sort of find that Rocky in me. And mm-hmm. so I took a lot of what he was doing,
but still made it your own.
Still make it. It's all about Rocky's heart, so it has to have truth, and it has to have comes from someplace deep inside of you.
To that point, I would like to quote your wife on something about you at the time. Quote, "My dear darling sweet husband is a method actor, so there was definitely a gloomy cloud over the home during Rocky. Andy's a really funny guy. He's funny at home. He's funny everywhere. And it was the one time he wasn't funny. He didn't have that lightness about him. He was really tired. He was getting hit in the head 50 times a day. I won't say he was unpleasant to be around, but that was the most different he's ever been in our marriage, because Rocky was coming home. Andy Carl was not coming home at that point," close quote. Does that sound,
well,
from,
I mean,
your perspective, is that correct?
Every night was a fight. I'm getting beat in the head, and sometimes I get hit pretty
actually
hard.
Actually hit, right.
But
it's choreographed, but
it's
you can't do everything.
It's all full contact, but it's choreographed, so we know how to roll with the punches, and we don't, like, swing as hard as we can. Sometimes there was a percentage of these hits that would come, because instinctually in our bodies when we're hitting, if you get like a little energy behind it, it'll come rock you. And I like blacked out for like a second every now and again, or I'd get hit really hard where my neck would be like, wow.
Yeah.
So I would talk back with punches and I'd hit harder to his body. It's like, please don't hit me hard or I will hit you hard as well. So in that sense, if you watch the first couple scenes of Rocky, he starts off with a fight and then he goes home, ices his head, looks at a sort of like a place where he just wants to lay down, mm-hmm. not deal with anything, talk to his turtles. I would talk to my dogs and I would go ice my, you know, my neck and sort of that was my life for, yeah. you know, for 9 months or something like that from rehearsals till then.
And so, you know, to some extent, this was really bearing fruit. You got rave reviews. You get your first Tony nomination for Best Actor in a Musical. But what I think you were referring to a few moments ago about the challenges of selling a musical in any situation, but now one that is based on Rocky and it's playing at a place as large as the Winter Garden, the show was struggling to make money, right? And I remember people speculating at the time that this was maybe because women don't want to see a show about boxing and men are reluctant to see a musical. So that doesn't leave you with a lot of other people. It killed me, though, so I can't even imagine for you, because anyone who did see it was just blown away by the whole spectacle of it and the whole thing. So I just wonder, you know, it sounds like it was a very tough thing when you've put years of your life into bringing this thing to fruition, and then just 9 months into it, you're having, and when you guys couldn't be doing anything, it's not like somebody wasn't pulling their weight. You're just hearing that it's not performing.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's one of the harder parts of doing anything in this entertainment business is the amount of time that you spend doing it to prepare it to be something great. And then you just, once it's out there, you kind of have to let it see how audiences are going to like it, how it's going to play, how it's going to sell. That's part of the territory. I did everything I could to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And so the people who did see it had an incredible experience. Mm-hmm. They're screaming Rocky at the end. Mm-hmm. They're cheering for me. I'm bloodied. I'm sweating. You know, it's one of the experiences, like, I felt good about what I did. Yeah. So I don't look back at it in any sort of regret of like, how do we not sell? That's totally my fault. Right. Or it was just, again, like I said, it takes so many things to fire correctly for a show to become a hit. But I still look back at it as like, I found something, a fire in me that maybe I had, like, from doing this for so long, maybe I needed to find that fire and climb that mountain and realize that this is the kind of stuff it takes to become next, to take yourself to the next level.
And it did not knock you down, because a year later, you're back in on 20th Century with Krista Chenoweth in a show that probably got the best reviews of anything you've ever done, right?
Yeah. So after Rocky, what happens? Oh, yeah. It didn't feel like a year. It was like 6 months, something. Anyway, probably after Rocky, anything felt like just a little bit of rest.
Yeah.
Was great. But yeah, on the 20th Century, another Scott Ellis directed show. So I had sort of a rapport with him, and it was with Roundabout as well. Mm-hmm. And it was this, again, it was another show that I was like, I'm not familiar with the show. Mm-hmm. Kevin Kline played it. So, you know, again, it's like, I feel like people call me now to step into big shoes.
Yeah.
Rocky, Jesus, Kevin Kline, now Bill Murray. It's something where maybe I have that sort of trust from people that they know that I'm going to bring stuff to it, but I'm not going to, like, you know, ruin it.
Right.
That's kind of basically, that's what I tell myself every day. Just don't ruin it. So, yeah, with On the 20th Century, a great chance to show off the comedy skills, which obviously, so, you know, as my wife had said that, you know, I was Rocky then, and now I was probably a little happier doing On the 20th Century. Just to let
people know, this was like a buffoonish Errol Flynn, like early days Errol Flynn sort of climbing movie star who's an egotistical, like, to the point of being hilarious.
Yeah, it was pure ego. Right. It was purely about his shell and about, you know, making the next move to have the biggest star be the woman that he's with. He was riding her coattails, much like I did with Kristen Chenoweth in the actual.
And how's it working with her?
It was great. It was many people. When I was doing Rocky, I was like, okay, this is hopefully my Wicked moment where you get noticed and then people start, like, seeing that you can, you know, carry a show on your shoulders in that sense. And, you know, in some ways it did, some ways it didn't. At least they called me for 20th Century to be paired up with her. When I looked at the size of me at 6'2 and her at 4 foot something, I knew immediately this is going to be hilarious.
Right, and you were literally, like, bench pressing her in the show.
Yeah, I was doing dumbbell lifts with her. And it was all sort of, like, you know, physical and craziness that she and I both connect on a very big level. She's a big goofball, and it's great. And she's extremely talented, but also just like doesn't take herself seriously in the way where it's like, I'm such a star, don't touch me. She takes her career very seriously, but she's really a funny, funny girl.
And so for you, that's second year in a row you're a Tony nominee, best featured actor in a musical in this case. And I imagine that is, you know, all of this is somewhat what led the way to the Groundhog Day.
Yeah, Matthew Warchus saw me in 20th Century. He knew I could be a buffoon, but he also knew I had a dark side with some Rocky, and they needed a comedian. They needed somebody who could handle the singing. The singing is kind of all over the place with Groundhog Day, from swing to like a rock ballad. I have to sing. Also, be in that position of the responsibility of being in that lead position, which is it's a huge responsibility. I would say this show is just as physical. Yeah. Groundhog Day is just as physical as Rocky was.
And on the 20th Century, you're doing a lot of physical stuff.
Luckily, I had some offstage time.
Right.
But here again with Groundhog Day, I'm offstage for maybe like 3 minutes of the entire show. So it's a privilege, but it's another like getting there and work hard.
And you were familiar with the movie, I imagine?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I grew up with some Bill Murray. Let me tell you, Ghostbusters was like, I know this, like, I remember standing in line when I was a kid, like, for two showings at the movie theater.
Oh, really?
Ghostbusters was that big of a hit.
Yeah.
You'd have to wait for like two showings of the movie in order to go in for the next movie.
Right.
So, and Bill Murray's just, today he's still just like rocking out these great roles and having also, he's got that wink in his eye all the time.
Yeah.
You never know if he's going to be a good guy, or when you find the goodness within him, it always comes with like a weight of someone who needs to get there. He's, you know, he's your ultimate Scrooge type of actor.
The challenge that comes with the part of Phil Connors, this weatherman who ends up reliving Groundhog Day over and over, is that it seems to me like we have to reach the conclusion early on that Phil is a huge asshole, right?
Mm-hmm.
Without coming to dislike him so much that he can't redeem himself. And when it's Bill Murray, we know we have a history with Bill Murray before we see that. So maybe you're even less, you know, you kind of assume Bill's going to come around and redeem himself just because we know it's Bill.
Mm-hmm.
For you, who some of these people that are coming to see the show may not have seen before, did you feel that was a big hurdle? How do you walk that line between making this guy so unlikable early on and yet not go over that line?
It's one of my favorite things to do is play the guy that everybody loves to hate. I found that in Jersey Boys. Again, like we're talking about all these shows that I've done, I'm pretty much putting them all in a big jar, shaking it up, drinking that before a show and realizing that it's everything that I've done ever in my life. Also coming with the actor's bitterness about, oh, I didn't get that, or it's like, I've been working so hard, and I don't get this, blah 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 blah, all this stuff. You can easily fall into the trap of thinking as an actor like how awful this career is. So that was my way of finding the bitterness of Phil Connors, was just taking all the things that I avoid thinking of as an actor to stay positive, just grabbing onto the bad and just, you know, making it apparent that I'm not happy to be there.
Right.
And the town that appears on stage really is the happiest musical theater town. It's almost so saccharine sweet because you're hearing all these people sing this hilarious Punxsutawney song that Tim mentioned so great at writing a style of music that fits the type of people. And they're all smiles and they're all happy to be there. It's very easy for me to just play the exact opposite.
Right.
I've even heard like people telling me, I've had friends come to see a show. I was like, there was no way you were going to be redeemed watching that first act. I was like, how is anybody going to like this guy?
Right.
And I was like, awesome. I did my job.
Yes. Exactly.
That's where I find a lot of, I love that type of compliment.
So you guys initially did this at the Old Vic in London. You get rave reviews. Eventually you won the Best Actor in a Musical, Olivier, and then you come here. And one question I had is, just doing any show, I would think, is somewhat inherently repetitive. You've got to do this 8 times a week, usually, whatever. But then to also have to do the exact same things a million times within that show, do you go a little bit crazy with this one?
I go really smart about it.
Yeah.
I've had to be really smart about all the choices and about staying awake and aware, never going on any sort of like, you're just taking my brain out of it and just playing whatever's happening, because I can't. So every night you're getting me fully aware. And anytime that I might drift off a little, or I always find myself immediately having to be grabbed back into the show, because I have to remember that this is the first day when I say this line. The second day I come around and I change that up a little. The third day is a little bit different, but they're all relatively the same movements, same actions. So what's easier about my part is that I'm linear. I can see what's happening all the time, and I can change it up in order to go to the next day. The other actors have to repeat a lot of stuff exactly like they did the next day and the next day. So that's, I feel like their job is actually a little harder than mine in that sense. But repeating it over and over again, the journey of Phil Connors is so beautiful to me in so many ways, personally and professionally. I have nothing but joy every time I do it. Some days it's harder than others. As matinees, I wake up and it's it's like there's a big journey ahead of me. But by the end of the show, I just and the audiences have just been so great in London as well as here. Unexpectedly amazing audiences. I knew how good it is. I just wanted people to see how good it is. So telling that story to people every night is that gets me through.
With our last couple minutes here, I just want to ask you. You guys have had. And you in particular have had this unbelievable last few weeks, which I want to bring us up to the present. First of all, let's start with the, you know, an obstacle that you all faced. Talk about the first preview here in New York of the show.
I have never been on a more crazy journey, even from London.
Yeah.
It's just been like an insane amount of patience and courage and positive forces to get us all through, because there's been a lot of like tears, and it's been the craziest experience because it is so complex and because we have such a story to tell. So the stage is actually made up of five different revolves on the stage. This enables us to forward time theatrically. It's also very cinematic for the audience, because they see people passing in front who are just standing still, and the next person sings, and the next person sings. So it's very beautiful in the way that it's staged, but it's also very complex, which requires a very complex floor. It doesn't look that way from the audience, because the show needs to look pretty analog as far as what type of stagecraft we're using. So combining all of that, plus incredible choreography, plus the floor moving underneath you while people are in tap shoes, or I'm doing like leapfrogs, or I'm jumping up on something, or, you know, and required to remember all these crazy lines and how we repeat them over and over again. It's very complex, most complex show I've ever had to do. So the first night of previews, the floor was having trouble because just in electrical issues, especially with Con Edison, I mean, of all the things that were just like sort of failing us, where like the electricity of the city is failing us. So the floor got stuck and jammed, and actually a piece of stuff underneath of there broke, which they found out later. Total fluke thing that never has happened
at the
first preview in front of an audience who were very like happy to be there. So first 15 minutes I'm in, show's rocking, people are loving it, floor stopped for a good 10 minutes. They realize they can't start the floor up.
In the meantime, what are you doing?
I'm backstage like going, really? This is happening right now? Matthew Warsh just comes back and basically comes up with the idea. It's like, what if we did a concert version for everybody? I was like, yes, I know this material stands on its own.
Yeah.
We got all these chairs from pieces from the stage and just chairs we had backstage. We sat, everybody who had a line or a song stood up and came forward and sort of half blocked something. And I tell you, man, that audience was with us the entire time, and they gave us such love, and the material was so funny, and they knew how to suspend their disbelief anyway, because that's what you do in the theater. You kind of have to suspend your disbelief and be involved in this world that's being played out in front of you. I think it was one of the more unique, more special performances of theater I've ever been
So that's the very beginning of previews. Now, 72 hours before opening night, this would have been Friday, April 14th. You're in the second act of the preview, and what happens?
It's a number called Philanthropy, where I'm saving everybody's life, or just saving their day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm running back and forth from stage left to stage right. It's a constant number where I'm moving and running and catching falling cats from the
from the ceiling and you know, fixing a holster for a gun here, then running off and changing a tire. It's something Phil has discovered that he can do. He knows everything that's happening, so he does all this stuff. So I'm at top speed, running from stage right to left, leapfrogging over somebody to catch a woman falling out of a ladder. This is my Superman moment. So this is towards the end of that number, and I land wrong on my left leg, and my knee just slams into my other knee, full ACL tear, which I didn't know at the time. I just knew that I went down hard. I luckily had put my forearm in front of me because there was a ladder that I catch her from, came straight from my head, and I put my forearm up. I didn't realize I had done that. I think it was instinct because I had a huge bruise for a couple of days. I didn't realize where that was from.
And you're in excruciating pain from the knee?
I was more in shock and awe of, I knew everything at that. It's hard to even think about today because I don't like thinking about this, mm-hmm. but I just want to go dark for this moment because mm-hmm. the after effect is something interesting. I had never sort of felt any loss like that in my life. I had 3 days before we were opening, and I had just won the Olivier. I had just gotten all these, I heard about good reviews. I heard people were just like slamming us with such good love for this show. And my producers were happy and everybody was happy. And just before the show ends, I go down so hard and I realized I had lost everything, all gone. I don't like talking. I hate talking about it because I haven't really been able to deal with it fully yet. Yeah. It's still a tender moment. But that's what I was hurt about most. The pain really didn't affect me. And actually, I've never had a pain pill since we started this, since I got this thing, because I also think ACLs are not really connected to a lot of nerve endings. So they're just, once they're gone, they're gone and you can't walk. It'll hurt to walk. Mm-hmm. I just laid on the floor sobbing in front of the crew, in front of the cast, in front of the production team, because I had lost it all right at the pinnacle with a show that was going to do better than anything I had been involved with before. And it was everything personal to me because I'm so in love with the show. Mm-hmm. So I spent like 15 minutes I'd say that 5 minutes just sobbing. Then 5 minutes thinking about what the hell are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And then I realized that.
Because in the meantime, the curtains come down.
The EMTs have shown up. And I'm sitting backstage just trying to figure out what the hell to do. And then I realized my next song is called Seeing You, which is really Phil Connors' time to access his time with this crowd, with the people behind him, and sing about something that is deeper within himself. And at that point, I told the EMT guys, just like, here, I'll sign that. Go away. I don't want you guys. I'm going to limp out on stage. I'm going to do this last number for this audience. And I sang the song with a cane in one hand and just limping through the next scene, which is really just, I had two more scenes to go. Mm-hmm. But at that time, it's when I look back at the crowd that's on stage and I sing about how much I haven't seen. And now I see so many things within everybody, and they were all in support of me. And so it became this huge life lesson thing that was happening all at once in the context of 15 minutes of my life. And it's so many things that are still happening and so many realizations that have come since then that it's every time I do the show from now on, it's a bigger experience. It's always been big for me, but this is a life lesson champion moment, you know, also going to the depths of seeing everything go away, to the wave of love coming at me, the appreciation for where I am in my life, and the appreciation for all the time we've just discussed on mm-hmm. your podcast today of where I've come from mm-hmm. to be here, all out on stage for the audience. And I have no problem exposing that to people because it's all been done for them. And so it's beautiful. It's beautiful and horrible and tragic and wonderful and elating and special. And I don't recommend it for anybody.
No, but
it became that decision of, this is either going to define you or this is going to crush you. And I chose for it to define me in that way where I'm going to get up. I don't like wearing a brace, which I still am wearing for the shows that I'm doing.
Before we even get to the current, let's just stay for people who may not have been following this, which it's been unbelievable because you finished the show, which not many people would have done. You then, I guess, go off to the hospital. You get to figure out what the situation is. Correct me if any of this is wrong, but the next day you do not do the show.
Correct.
Your understudy does it. Sunday,
the matinee was canceled.
Matinee is canceled.
They rehearsed all day, and the understudy did the last show of the week, which
he
is
did
Saturday.
The evening, right? There's no, happened, fortunately, not to be a Sunday show. And then Monday night, when you guys opened, you were back.
Yeah. This the MRI with the doctor showed full tear. How do you come back from this? There, everybody was in the idea that, like, let's try to get you back for Monday. Don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going
to
get it done.
They're saying we want to get you back, or you're saying I'm going to be back.
My wife is saying more like, I can't believe she had the vision. She said, while I'm in the hospital, it's like, you're doing Monday night, wow. Your opening night. Are you going to sit at home or out in the audience and let your opening night pass you by? In that selfish way, like, no, but I can't walk. Mm-hmm. I couldn't walk Friday night, and I was on crutches most of Saturday, but I was in physical therapy the next day trying to figure out how does this ligament look? Can you straighten your knee? I could barely straighten or bend, but mm-hmm. I was like really accessing a lot of like mind control over that and trying to push. So 72 hours later, I showed up on Monday, which was our opening day. I showed up on Monday morning at 9:30 to work out some things that I needed to change a little, because this show's very physical.
Yeah.
Just basically I couldn't, you know, do a couple of turns and things like that. The entire cast shows up at 10 a.m. and I'm still indebted to all of them, because on their opening night, they had to show up at 10 a.m. and rehearse all day before their opening night. So, you know, the girls have to get their hair done. They bought dresses for this night. The guys are like, you know, I don't want to be here anymore. We've been rehearsing every day since, you know, the dawn of time. And this is how I felt, because I told them, I'm so sorry. I emailed everybody. I said, I'm so sorry. And they were all just like, shut up. We're going to be there for you. And so it was astounding that amount of love was happening, which got me through, because I was on my feet for 16 hours from rehearsals to the opening night party. I don't know how we did it, but we did it. And
people went nuts.
People went nuts, because here's the thing. It became a Karate Kid moment. And like, I wasn't playing it out like that. Right. I was like, because somebody told me about it, showed me a GIF of Karate Kid. And I was like, oh my God, that's exactly how I felt when I was watching Karate Kid as a kid. You know, here's this guy who has his legs sweeped from out under him, and he has his last move to, you know, win the big battle. And so right. That was it. And from playing Rocky, I knew it's like champions just, they get up. There's nothing that keep it. Life can knock you down, but it's how tough you are to stand up. You know, all these life lessons are flashing before my eyes. So that night was very special. Yes, I was limited to a little bit of a limp in my walk, which, you know,
understandable.
But I tell you, when you're faced with that kind of stuff, the acting becomes, the story becomes so much a bigger thing. I became a worse of a jerk and more of an evolved person by the end of that night. I think, you know, my wife kept telling me, it's like, I've never seen you act that thing better than that night. And it's true. It's like, when I didn't have this, I didn't have my leg, I didn't have the physical stuff to depend on as much, it became about this story, which I knew worked from that opening night that our stage broke. Mm-hmm. We have this immense story that needs to be told, and people love this story, and it teaches a lot of lessons. So again, singing that last song for that opening night was just as profound. But it had a whole new meaning for me internally, and sure for the audience as well, because they knew somebody was up there trying, living that thing of the show must go on. And that's something that's, you know, through the career or the shows that I've done, it's like, I've seen it a million times, and now here's my opportunity.
Well, I had the opportunity to see you that within a week after this all went down, and I mean, to be honest, I forgot that there had even been an injury until you kind of make the joking, winking reference within the show referring to your knee brace. But I mean, it's just an unbelievable story. And again, I mentioned to you earlier that I've only been really doing this beat for 4 years. And so I don't feel like I have the observer, performer familiarity with anyone else than I, you know, to the extent that I do with you from having seen Rocky on the 20th Century and now Groundhog Day. And so just generally, I'm excited to see you do anything, but to see, you know, what you've had to overcome with this, it's really special. So I just tip my cap to you. You're now going back to a full schedule. You'd only missed a few matinees, I think.
I missed two matinees last week, and that was the second week. The first week after the injury, I missed four shows because doctors were just don't do this. But after I got through this week, then starting the week now, I'm starting full schedule, and the doctors are impressed.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing.
And the professional therapists athletes are impressed.
Things are gone for a year.
I'm impressed.
It's just an amazing thing. So really,
it's hard to be cocky though, once because you'll have a little tweak in your leg. You're like, oh, I don't feel. No, but I gotta get through.
People should know, like, you know, it's hard enough to do eight shows a week of anything when you're not on stage the whole time, when you're not severely injured. And when you're not, you know, dealing with the emotional side of it, which, as you've acknowledged, is sometimes probably as a result of this worse than the physical. So anyway, I just tip my cap to you, and I really thank you for this. And
there's
and
no business like show business.
No, man.
Listen to that song. You'll hear it again.
You'll get it.
And you'll get it. But I just want to say I realize this is how theater people in the theater are.
Yeah.
Backstage, on stage, producers. We get this show on, and the show must go on. And I have never been taught that lesson stronger than I have been now. And if I can pass that on to anybody else who joins the theater, that's what we're made of like steel. So let's do it.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.